Welcome to today's 6 CEU seminar entitled Professionally and Ethically Sound Christian Psychotherapy. I'll be your presenter for today's seminar. My name is Michelle Sparks, and I'm the owner and director of River of Life Professional Counseling in Hilliard, Ohio, which is a private practice on the west side of Columbus, Ohio. So I've been interested in this topic for years for several reasons. One, because I've noticed that for people who mention that spirituality, and specifically Christian spirituality, is a significant factor to them, usually it's important that they want to know that there's freedom in their assessment, in their dialogue with their therapist, in the treatment planning, and in the actual treatment approach that incorporates their worldview. We'll talk today about how it is possible to use therapy approaches that are efficacious, that have been proven in the literature, but to also incorporate the worldview of the client, be that Christian psychotherapy or other areas that are very important to clients. Keep in mind, when we're talking about cultural diversity, when we're talking about ethics, we're talking about the client's perception of what contributes to their presenting concerns and what can be a solution to solving the problem. People who specifically call in, I find, to River of Life Professional Counseling, a lot of times are people who are requesting what they would call Christian therapy, but professional, clinically, ethically sound psychotherapy, but that has that respect for their Christian worldview. They want to know that if they bring up things like they pray or they, quote, talk to God, that they're not going to be seen as delusional, or that if they're of a specific denomination or worldview in terms of expression or rituals that are congruent with their worldview, that they're not going to be looked down upon for their beliefs or for implementing certain rituals in line with their practices. They also may talk about support systems that they found within a church community or things that are spiritually uplifting to them. Their values or their belief systems may be very, very important to them in terms of bringing comfort or solution for the presenting concerns. So it's very important to take these into consideration. For me, I am a Christian, and I also do have a background as a licensed, ordained, non-denominational Christian minister, as well as an LPCC counselor. I've done ministry as well as clinical counseling in various settings. Spirituality is something that impacts our lives. It's really important, like I said and alluded to a little bit ago, to remember that spirituality is one piece of who a person is. And when I say spirituality, that could be whether they don't believe there's a God at all, whether they believe there is a God, what shape they think that God takes, what it looks like, what ideas about spirituality they've been raised up with, the narratives of their parents, especially growing up. Because we know that when you're a child, oftentimes you don't get to choose the narrative for yourself. So what are the lessons? What was role model for them and their family of origin? And we'll talk today, too, about significant life events and the role that that plays in terms of spirituality. For example, I remember in my life when I came home from my first major, like the Thanksgiving and Christmas break from college, I remember helping to take care of my grandmother who was involved with hospice due to dying from bone cancer. And myself and my cousin, who was my same age, ended up staying on our college breaks over at my grandparents' house. We attended to my grandmother. We helped give her her medication. We helped put a cool rag in her head when she needed. She was bedridden. And so they were just trying to make her comfortable before she died. But what to me was significant was the way that she approached the narrative after she was being told that she was diagnosed with bone cancer, and especially in those last few months. She actually wanted people to sing psalms. She planned her funeral and included in the funeral basically a celebration of her path to heaven. So much so that her last song was the Hallelujah Chorus. She said, I want this to be a time of rejoicing when I do pass, because I believe that this is going on to a better life. So that caused me to evaluate my spiritual narrative and where I was at in undergraduate life, what I had been raised up with, what the beliefs of my parents were, what people around me in the college setting and my religion and philosophy classes there were telling me, and then what I really believed when it came down to it about life, death, and meaning-making, trying to make sense of things that didn't always make sense, or things, times when bad things seem to happen to good people. So we'll talk about a lot of those different angles today in today's seminar. As we go into today's seminar, I'm going in with the assumption that all aspects of someone's narrative, including spirituality, are significant and need to be taken seriously in terms of the work we do with our clients. I've included a quote in your PowerPoints that I think really summarizes the importance of attending to spirituality when it's a significant factor for a client. Spirituality is a universal dimension of life that lends meaning to our existence, sets a moral standard for living, and assumes some sense of moral connection among people at the very heart of our humanity. Some spirituality is based on ethics and philosophy. Other spirituality sees its source and end in the supernatural realm of a deity, and is most often expressed in formal religion. Both forms speak to issues of morality, meaning, and the nature of an individual's relationship to the world, whether or not it's supernatural. So, think back to your graduate school when you were working in terms of your social work, your counseling training, and we were developing competencies, particularly in the area of ethics and the area of cultural diversity. Think back how much emphasis or how little emphasis was made on dimensions of spirituality. And the fact is that there are considered in the literature 9 core competencies in terms of incorporating spirituality into counseling. I find that we oftentimes don't have enough training in these dimensions that might be very important to our clients. So, for example, one of the competency areas that the literature would suggest is having sensitivity to spiritual issues and communication. Think about some of the dialogues we have with our clients and how that nature of the therapeutic alliance and the therapeutic relationship through the dialogue really fosters some kind of narrative for the client about how do I approach life? What has my story been to this point? How do I develop a story that involves health, wellness, wholeness, newness, and a sense of fulfillment, a sense of competency that I can face issues that might have been difficult to this point? So when someone has a certain worldview regarding spirituality, it's very important to be sensitive to that in terms of communication. It's also important to self-evaluate our own understanding. What areas are we aware of? What knowledge base do we have? Maybe about certain religious backgrounds and their views? What interactions have we had with various groups of people in terms of spirituality? For example, I just love talking with people about spirituality-based issues. And while my knowledge base and competency is primarily in working with people in the Christian worldview, I've had a number of people that have enjoyed coming to me for clinical and ethically based counseling that have not had Christian worldviews. It's been fascinating to approach with them their spirituality issues in terms of, help me understand, teach me, what's your take on this? So I've had people, for example, that have had a Hindu worldview, and they've had to explain to me their take on certain concepts, their take on what meditation involved, their take on spiritual narrative, and what part that had in their day-to-day life. I remember one gentleman in particular that was dealing with being on probation for a federal crime. And I remember that this gentleman was really wrestling with the issue of the idea that good people deserve good things and bad people or unethical, immoral people deserve bad things, which I think at some level we all wrestle with that issue, right? Well, this gentleman, client of mine, had been part of a group that had done some embezzlement of funds through one of the large banks federally here, and he was coming to me for counseling related to that and some other issues. And so, as he was going through additional schooling and training, he actually, after the embezzlement, got offered a job that was a six-figure income, over $100,000 a year. And he really wrestled with it. He thought, man, I did something so bad. I assisted this other group of people in embezzling from people's accounts through this certain bank. And people I didn't know, innocent lives I hurt, and just messed up so many things because I was angry with the way my bosses and the management of that particular bank system treated me. So he wrestled with that. I deserve punishment for this. I deserve consequences. And I remember one session in particular mentioning to him, what do you do with the idea of, does life give you another chance? Is there room for mercy? And I remembered him educating me on the idea that in his religion, and these are his literal words, he said, in my religion, there's no concept like mercy. He said, now in the Christian religion, there's mercy. So I understand why you're saying that. But he said, there's nothing like that. Basically, in my religion, what he told me, he said, you get what you deserve. And he's like, and I was a very bad person. I did a very bad thing. So I remember processing with him. I said, so then how do you reconcile? Help me understand that sometimes when people do very bad things, life gives them another chance. Or when sometimes someone really puts a lot of effort in to be kind, good-hearted, good-natured, and try to be ethical and moral, that they get cred from life. And it really caused him to evaluate that. So listening to his understanding of things was really important to him. A third area of these core competencies of spirituality and counseling is to be respectful of spiritual themes. So, for example, one thing I'll often hear of in discussion with my Christian clients is their idea of, quote-unquote, talking with God. And to me, being a Christian, where prayer is important, where that's part of my worldview, it's part of my day-to-day lifestyle and decision-making, I understand how that's incorporated. But someone else, when I worked in other settings, like a secular mental health hospital setting, there were a number of colleagues who thought people who, quote, heard from God were delusional. they assumed that we can't hear from God. And so it was really important to make sure in my note-taking, in my treatment planning, in my communication with the treatment team, that I documented the nature of this client's spiritual worldview and if it's consistent with what they believe. I remember years ago, I worked for a community mental health in another county, and I had a preteen girl who was having dreams about angels and angelic visitations. She was having a great deal of anxiety in her life. And based on her religious worldview and the branch of Christianity that she and her family were in, they definitely believed that in modern day situations that God still desires to communicate to people. And they believe that that communication can occur through reading of scripture. They believe that it could be through dreams or visions. They believe that there could be spiritual experiences in the present. And so what they struggle with is, with me working at a community mental health setting, the idea of possibly being considered for medications for their psychological issues. So we tried to use several counseling approaches, and the girl's panic disorder sort of symptoms seemed to wax and wane, and there were moments that the panic seemed to get worse. And so I ended up having to work with the mom about her worldview about, is medication an okay thing? Is it bad? Is it immoral? And then I also had to work with a psychiatrist of that community mental health who didn't understand the specific Pentecostal Christian worldview of this mom and her daughter, and the fact that their beliefs were consistent with having experiential encounters with the Lord, such as the dreams and the visitation she said she had with the angels that were encouraging to her. So we found that that was very helpful when I was able to explain that spiritual narrative being consistent with the spiritual practices of that family to the psychiatrist. We were able, as a team, clinically working with this young girl and her mom, to have the girl try medications to assist with the neurotransmitters and the rebuilding of that biologically and biochemically. The mom became open to that. We saw a decrease in her anxiety. We saw that the daughter was more open even to the techniques of psychotherapy, and again, to clinically proven, ethically, you know, substantiated types of therapy. So again, we're not talking about an either or thing. We're talking about applying clinically efficacious, ethical types of approaches, but in a manner that's respectful to the client's worldview, including their spirituality. So one of the other competencies we want to look at is assessing the relevance of spiritual domains. So there may be some clients that's not even something they want to explore. That's not even a part of their personality they're ready to go into. They don't want to talk about that. And respecting that. I remember I had a guy years ago when I worked for another person's practice who came in because his son had recently died. And this was a father who was in a relationship with a woman, and they had these two children at a very, very young age. He admitted to essentially abandoning her and the kids, and then later in life, pretty recent to when I started counseling him, he sought out the kids, and they were in their 20s by then, the two boys, and began a relationship with them. So as he sought out them and began a relationship with them, when we were doing the psychosocial assessment, I kind of talked with him about his worldview, his beliefs, what was important to him in terms of treatment planning. And his comment was that he didn't want any Christian or spirituality-based anything included in his counseling, that he was ticked off with God because he had finally done the right thing and reached out and felt like he atoned and made amends for the years that he felt were wasted, and then he felt like he got a slap in the face by God. So, out of respect for that, we didn't go there. We didn't talk about that. We did traditional-based grief counseling. We talked about stages of grief. We talked about normalizing grief and, you know, not having shame for having to adapt to, from moment to moment, different needs about grief. We talked about responding to other people's ideas and cliches and bumper sticker answers about what should or shouldn't happen, and then how to assess what he needs in the moment. We process through that grief. We process through a variety of different kind of emotions, like the anger, the sadness, the sense of it just not making sense to him. Then eventually one day he came to me after several sessions of straight clinical psychotherapy for managing his grief. And it ended up that he made a comment about his anger towards God, about his frustrations of his time being robbed away when he was ready to make a difference, and how it just didn't make sense to him. So again, I asked him the same question that I asked him that first session about his willingness or lack of willingness to approach spirituality. And his answer was somewhat different at that time. And it was different because he said some events had happened in his life in those months that we had already been doing psychotherapy. He said some people had approached him from a local church in his area and started to tell him things that began to somewhat make sense and make light of the searching and seeking that he was going through. So he was willing to look at, I've got to come up with some kind of explanation for why in the world I'm so angry and why sometimes bad things happen to good people even when they've made better choices. And so at that time, there was a readiness. So keep in mind, like with any dimension with our client, when we talk about stages of change, from one moment, they may feel like they don't even want to go there. Another moment, they may say, yeah, I do. And they may not use necessarily the spiritual words that you would use. They might not use a religious language or the theological language, but it may be their version of basically saying, I'm mad at God. I'm ticked off. This is not just. This is not right. This can't be fair. So that's still their processing of things that may have a spiritual nature. Another core competency we want to look at with our clients is finding out what their beliefs are. And for any client, when I talk about multicultural counseling, I talk about finding out what the client's beliefs are about what contributed to the cause of their presenting concerns and what they define in terms of operational definitions of wellness, healing, wholeness. What would that be for them? How do we know when we've achieved what we need to in therapy? What would that look like? So that's important to go over with them. It may be important in terms of other competencies the literature suggests to even describe our clinical practices in terms of a spiritual context. For example, one of the approaches we might talk about later today that is supported in the clinical literature is called rational Christian therapy. It's basically a Christian version of rational emotive therapy, or CBT types of therapy. It looks at how our thought patterns and our behavior choices can influence our feelings and can foster depression, anxiety, and unhealthy mood disorders. But it also incorporates someone's spiritual worldview into that. When I'm describing that, if someone might have a Christian worldview, we might look at, for example, the scripture that says, "And as a man thinks, that's how he is." Or out of the mouths of people comes what's in their heart. This would be a spiritual way of lending support, again, to the cognitive behavioral efficacious types of treatment. To basically say, yes, your thought patterns can influence your behaviors, can influence your feelings. And so maybe identifying the thought patterns that aren't useful and helpful and are contributing to your presenting concerns can be very beneficial, and we can talk about how to change those. So one of the things we also might look at in terms of competency is what explanations the client gives for why things are happening the way they are now and where they believe they're at in terms of their spiritual development. As I've alluded to this point, this all falls under the rubric of multicultural competencies and meeting the client where he or she's at. Now, in the literature, they've done some studies about how much or how little education people who are mental health professionals had in the area of spirituality versus how much education and awareness and application they would like to have. While most counselors recognize the value of having some awareness and training of spiritual issues in counseling, very few said it really was an active part of their training and their coursework. So we see this gap between what we think would be useful, between what our clients may sometimes be asking for, and what we really have competency in. So how do we bridge that gap? When we're looking at CACREP, that's C-A-C-R-E-P, the abbreviation for the accreditation boards, the CACREP accreditation standards, they specifically mention spirituality. The American Counseling Association ethics talks about the fact, quote, that counselors must learn and acknowledge how their own cultural, ethnic, racial, and other tendencies affect their attitudes and behaviors. And the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy talks about how people who are marriage and family therapists must provide assistance without discrimination on the basis of race, age, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, disability, gender, health status, religion, national origin. And so all these areas, and again, note, I included religion is in their list, are very important to consider when we meet with a client. So it's saying that marriage and family therapists should not discriminate. They should also be aware of the influences of such factors. They should also, quote, advance the welfare of the client. And, quote, they should use appropriate services. So again, when we're talking about appropriate services, we have to be able to substantiate and provide an explanation if we were asked as to why did we do the treatment plan that we did. First of all, it needs to be something that the literature would support. Are the techniques that we're using for a given client congruent with what many other professionals in similar areas with similar clients would use? Does the literature support that? Then, knowing where my client's specifically at in terms of their spiritual journey, is this also respectfully incorporating that? So the suggestion the literature says is that it's pretty important for us to start incorporating spirituality even into our core counseling courses. They encourage people, even at the master's level when we're going through training, to evaluate things such as your individual views concerning religion and spirituality, how those may affect your role as a clinician, how those may affect your role in terms of responding to clients, and whether or not you think you will be able to empathize with clients who might have differing spiritual values than your own. That's significant because that's why it's so important for us to have that clinical supervision and also make sure that we're operating within a similar scope of practice of what other people would do with a given client. It's really important also to look at how we will keep our own spiritual values and beliefs from inappropriately influencing the counseling relationship. So an example of this I wanted to share with you. I remember years ago, I was doing clinical supervision in my practice with someone who was going for her independent LPCC licensure. And this was a young mom, this LPCC in training, and we had gotten a call at the practice. The call was for a client who was a mom who wanted help conveying to her kids and dealing with the transition that she wanted to not be a married woman anymore, not be a mom anymore, that she feels she had missed out on life, that she had wasted her time in the marriage and family role, and that she was leaving the kids. So, the worldview, of course, of myself personally, and of my intern at that time, I knew was one of the importance of marriage and family and home life. So I remember when I had gotten this call from this person, talking with my intern and us processing how will we keep our own spiritual values and beliefs about, wow, how can someone just up and leave a marriage and just abandon their kids like that? You know, so it's really tough because there's that thing of, wow, that's awful. You know, so you have your own judgment on the inside. But yet the mom was asking, the client was asking for assistance in how to make transitions to the new life that she wanted. She wanted to go back to college. She wanted to live as a single person. And so again, I had to do a lot of talking with my intern and processing within myself and with the team at our practice at the time about how we would clinically address the needs of this woman, even though some of the values and beliefs might be different from how we would handle a situation. Clinical supervision also should role model the importance of considering all aspects of cultural competence, including spirituality. So there's several different areas in terms of what we do in counseling and psychotherapy where spirituality might be integrated. We could start with things like the intervention and assessment skills. We could talk about how have we heard their narrative regarding the presenting concern, the problems, the approaches that might be most useful for this person. We can look at what interventions they might be willing to do and not willing to do. For example, like I alluded to earlier, I've had a number of clients who said that they have a Christian worldview who didn't want to consider the option of medication. Now, while my scope of practice is clearly not making judgments about medication or prescribing, there may be some clients who are on medication or where I may have to do some consultation with collateral sources like a psychiatrist or primary care physician. So it's very interesting that some clients will come in like, I just want the counseling. I'm not willing to consider any medication. Some people think that somehow less moral or not okay. And others believe that part of their Christian worldview is that God uses a variety of sources, including counseling, including ministry in the church context, including doctors. So that's where hearing that individual narrative of the client's important. Also looking in terms of their interpersonal assessment. How do they define things in terms of what a support system would look like for them? looking at how they conceptualize their problem, how we even choose and select treatment goals, and then also making sure that we are professionally and ethically competent. One of the things I want to say very clearly here, and I may say more than once today, is that ethically, we cannot possibly incorporate spirituality or say we're doing something for a spiritual reason that doesn't have a solid ethical foundation. So what I mean by that, just because someone might have a certain spiritual worldview, we still need to make sure that the techniques we're using are clinically sound, are backed by the literature. So that's, you know, if we're saying we're licensed as a mental health professional and our role is doing clinical psychotherapy, we need to make sure that while we're respectful and incorporating to the degree the client feels comfortable their spirituality, that it is something that is ethically sound. One of the things that I thought was an interesting quote out there is it said, worldviews are like sand. They get into everything. So keeping in mind again that our worldview, including spirituality, colors how we interpret events, our rationales behind events, why things have become conflict, what blesses and encourages someone, what hinders them, what it means to approach a client or a supervisee in a context of speaking the truth in Christian love, how this is involved in terms of correction, gentleness, and humility, how we do accurate but balanced appraisals of ourselves and others that incorporate both accuracy and also mercy where there's areas that may need to be having some more growth. And other issues that are, to a degree, a spiritual issue in terms of supervision are things like being good stewards of the gifts and talents we have. So in terms of counseling supervision, one of the things a supervisor can do is role modeling for the supervisee how to assess clients in clinical situations in terms of spirituality, how to make use of resources for integrating spirituality with clients when appropriate. For example, there's things I still learn to this day and am learning and will be learning regarding different spiritual worldviews. And sometimes it may involve asking a client if they would be willing to sign a release of consent for me to consult with people that have been involved in their lives and influencing them spiritually. That might be someone that's a relative. That might be someone significant in their church, mosque, their temple. That might be someone who practices different spiritual rituals with them. Because, again, involving collateral sources or getting that information can help, again, to provide therapy that's beneficial to that client. It's important that we give supervisees an opportunity to assess their spirituality when it's appropriate, to role model that for them, to give attempts to actually integrate spirituality when it's a significant factor, and to role model how to do that with interventions, as well as to offer ongoing instruction. We can help supervisees differentiate between what their clients' beliefs and worldview are versus their own, and to make sure to keep those boundaries to where, again, they're not necessarily doing ministry or trying to preach, convert, or evangelize a client, but what they're doing is efficacious psychotherapy that respectfully involves that client's worldview. So you hear the difference. One of the key things that's really important is when there's a potential ethical violation, the board's going to look at what role did the client think you were in? And it's very important that we be clear with clients about that. That, for example, for me, in the context of River of Life Professional Counseling, my private practice, I'm an LPCC. I'm a professional clinical counselor. I work on terms of the diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders. I'm helping people develop skills for dealing with, changing, coping, overcoming certain things that have been issues in their life. So I'm doing professional clinical counseling. I encourage you to have a form letter for your clients that you give them that reinforces the idea of what professional clinical counseling entails, what the psychotherapy entails that you do. So, for example, I do diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders in such and such setting with such and such population. Also, that form letter should differentiate that this does not mean I'm a mediator, that I do supervision of visitations for children. It does not mean that I am acting as a minister or a discipler or a debater about your beliefs versus my beliefs. It does not mean that I'm imposing my values on you. So be very clear as to what these mean. One of the things that's going to be real important, and for many clients, is important when someone says they're looking for a religious or spirituality-based counselor, is finding out what that means to them. I have had the widest array of responses, all the way from, you know, when they ask, oh, do you do spiritual counseling? I'll ask them first, what does that mean to them? They said, well, we were looking up on the insurance panels. We wanted to make sure that the person who was doing our clinical counseling had a background in terms of spirituality and Christian issues. And so for some people, that might be, do you understand Christianity enough to allow me the freedom to talk about God, spiritual Christian worldviews, practices I do, prayer, rituals, church attendance, a lifestyle that might be congruent with certain beliefs. And so I have some people that say, oh, good, good. I'm glad that, you know, I have room to discuss those things without feeling judged. Then I have other people that say, you know what? I believe I need to get, quote, right with God, or I need to address this issue. I've had people that have called in, for example, saying, I'm having a hard time getting past some offenses in my life. I'm having a hard time dealing with issues of unforgiveness. Oh, this hurt, this pain, this stress of life, this grief is really weighing down on me. And they're struggling about how to, quote, operate out of a place where they're strong in their Christian or spiritual worldviews, but also real and authentic with themselves about the emotions that they're going through. So it may be that we need to consult. If we don't know what someone's worldviews are or what they entail, like I said, with releases of consent, possibly consult with their religious leaders. So we want to encourage that development. We want to, if we're a supervisor, we want to role model that spirituality can be included and part of what we do with our self-evaluation, our interactions clinically, the therapeutic alliance. So in terms of method, things like introspection, examination, and reflection may be used. Spiritual disciplines might be incorporated in someone's life. Things like involvement in a faith community or prayer may be important. I remember one of the Christian-based clinical counseling organizations I worked for when I was doing my first internship for graduate school had two different clinical team meetings. We had one that was pretty much a straightforward professional clinical team meeting, and then we had another one once a month that was a professional clinical team meeting, but incorporated for those of us who were counselors that wanted to offer spirituality or Christian-based services, because we had a number of people that contacted that agency that I was doing my internship at, wanting people with that worldview. Some didn't, some did. So we had different meetings to kind of address what the needs of the clients were. Now, one of the exercises I think is really useful, both for us in terms of as clinicians, our own self-examination, as well as in our work with our clients, is to look at some key terms that might be used in our clinical sessions at times. These terms don't mean the same thing to anybody. So, for example, spirituality, even as we're going into today's seminar talking about Christian and spiritual-based counseling, what is spirituality? For some people, that's rather vague and kind of just like a broad term. Then looking at what does religion mean? Usually people think of religion in terms of some kind of formal behaviors, exercises, or practices. What is that? What would that look like for the person? See, when we're talking about operational definitions, I explain and I address with my clients the idea of what I call a camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what would it see? What behaviors would show a person who was, quote, spiritual, or a person who was a religious person? I also look at other terms that I think are useful for us to evaluate and for us to hear what our clients would define as spiritual development. Even things like spiritual maturity. Now, one area that I think is really big, that at least with the clients that have crossed my path, is addressing the operational definitions of mercy and justice. Oftentimes, I've had clients, when they're trying to make sense and meaning of hurts, pains, and life events, that struggle with the concept of they want justice for someone who they believe did something wrong to them or someone else. But they want mercy for themselves. They want to know that someone understands their wrong behavior in context and accepts their apology and that there is a fresh start. Other things that we might want to go through in terms of operational definitions, things like what does church mean? What does heaven or hell mean? Keep in mind that these are definitions that have so many different subjective meanings to our clients, but also they're concepts that are hard for adults to grasp, much less children. I remember having clients that grew up in Christian homes, and on two different distinct cases, I remember kids that were around 8 to 10 years old. One was a girl, one was a boy, that both struggled with the idea of being worried that something was going to happen and they would end up in hell, or that they hadn't pleased God enough, and really struggled with guilt and doing things perfectly. And we had to kind of talk through with the parents the concept about how some of this stuff is very challenging for adults to grasp. And then when kids overhear adults talking about it in maybe a church concept or context, that it's very challenging for them as well. So what I like to do when I'm trying to assess and decide on an approach with a client is to look at it in terms of a narrative or a story. First, I might do this in terms of my awareness of spirituality in my own life. So I might take a look at factors like what has shaped my spirituality to this point, any people or places, significant events, where I believe I'm at today versus where I think I quote-unquote should be, Or another significant one is, what if I'm at a certain place, or I believe I'm at a place, and I believe God wants me to be at a different place? I can't tell you the number of times that I've had clients that have said, well, I think God wants me to think this and this, or I guess I should forgive that person, but I'm just not where God wants me to be. And so that's a significant thing that we need to address in terms of their belief systems, in terms of how merciful they may or may not believe God is, or what his rules include, or what they need to do to achieve a certain place. One of the things that we might want to do is look at what a holistic approach would involve. How would we involve people with different worldviews, especially spiritually? Now, there are in the literature some expectations that people who define themselves as conservative Christian counseling clients really tend to emphasize on. One, they do want respect for their worldview and acceptance of it. They may want incorporated into their sessions an ability to talk about certain moral teachings. This can include things like scriptures, Bible verses. It could be motivational literature. It could be prayer in session, or encouraging them to explore the role of prayer or rituals of a religious nature outside of session. It might be a matter of us helping listen to the story of their conversion experience, or where they were at before they felt that they reached a certain point, where they believe they're at now, what struggles they might be having now. So that we may need to also hear about things like their approach to what they would consider the religious quote-unquote authorities. There may be some people that might, you know, be kind of balk at people telling them what to do or what to believe. And there might be other people who would rather have someone they looked up to tell them, oh, you know, you should think this, this, this. That's significant information that helps us in terms of approaching counseling with our client. Some clients, especially again, that have a more conservative Christian worldview, prefer oftentimes us to use their religious language or metaphors in session. They prefer us to use religious examples, stories, or parables. They want us to be willing to listen to their spiritual experience and journey. They want us to try and have empathy for that. They prefer to be what they would call, quote-unquote, spiritually stimulated. They prefer to feel like they're growing spiritually. And that's where, again, I don't define what that is for them. I'm not in the role as a LPCC counselor of deciding what their spiritual growth should or should not entail. But if a client makes a mention or a phrase like, gosh, I know I'm not where God wants me to be, I might use their language and their phrase and say, oh, you feel like you're not where God wants you to be? Tell me more about that. How do you get in touch with what you think God wants for your life? You know, what has helped you to make that decision that you want to be at a different place than where you're at now? And how would you know that you are, in your opinion, more in line with what God wants? And hearing that. So a lot of times when you talk with someone who's requesting more of a Christian spirituality approach and worldview be incorporated, some of the goals that they verbalize are they want a closer relationship with God, a more fervent prayer life, a lifestyle that's consistent with traditional biblical values. They want encouragement of behaviors consistent with the values that they're talking about. Oftentimes, fact of the matter is, people want to know that you are on their wavelength. They may or may not feel comfortable with someone who can't talk their spiritual language. So again, this spiritual, this understanding, relating, talking their language begins with the assessment. If we do a thorough spiritual assessment for a client who's asking for that to be incorporated, this can enhance our ability to be empathic and to be sensitive toward the client's unique experiences. As weird as this may sound, it can also support our diagnosis about what they're considering healthy or unhealthy spirituality. For example, I think of a case when I was first starting my private practice and I was working for someone else's practice where a girl who had been in a cult ended up being referred to me by one of my other colleagues. And she said that she was fairly young. She was a young adult. And in that cult that she was in, the religious leaders had paired her up with a significantly older gentleman and said that they had decided that this was supposed to be her husband. She talked about some beliefs and doings in that religious group. And one of the things I remember her struggling with, she said, I remember each church service, they would march us up in front of the whole church and we were supposed to announce what we did wrong, what our sins were, what our shortcomings were. And the leaders of that church ended up telling us what we had to do to atone for that. And they decided that for us. So it wasn't like someone could pray or hear from God or make their own judgments. It was pretty much like the leaders of this group told them everything from who to marry, how to dress, what their consequences were or were not for their different behaviors. And so I remember this girl just struggling with, you know, I want to have a good relationship with God. And coming out of that cult, she was like, she was very fearful about trusting someone as a spiritual leader. In one way, she was wanting to balance, how do I respect someone who hopefully has had more study about religious areas, more experience, and might have more wisdom and knowledge in those areas than I do. But on the other hand, I've had pretty bad experiences where people, you know, had misused those. So helping to look at the diagnosis in the context of her unhealthy use of spirituality, where when she was in that cult, it was used as a method to control. The other thing that spiritual assessment does for us is it can help a counselor identify outcomes that would be considered healthy spiritually for a client. It can help us adapt counseling interventions personally to the spiritual needs and background of a client. So we want to look at the client's perceptions. We want to look at any issues the client is mentioning of a spiritual nature, and then work on doing the therapy. Now, I included a list in your PowerPoint that I think is really important in terms of really doing a comprehensive assessment about what spirituality means or may not mean to a given client. First of all, key question, do you even wish to discuss spiritual issues in counseling if they're relevant to you? That's important. Find out if it is, if it's not. If someone says, yes, I do, things like, do they believe in God? What is God to you? I like this fourth question or area that looks at using scaling, like a 1 to 10 scale. How important is spirituality to you? So again, it's not like me telling them a number about their life or making a judgment or defining for them what spirituality looks like. But I'm saying, okay, so I hear you saying you want Christian-based, religious-based, or spirituality-incorporated, you know, types of counseling. Can you tell me on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is that to you? And they may say, oh, a 9. I really need to make sure that that's incorporated. okay, where do you believe you're at with that right now compared to where you'd like to be? So some of that scaling that we use in our strengths-based solution-focused approaches can be very useful when we're assessing that. Someone also might want to share with us what their religious affiliation is and how important that is or is not. Like I said, for some people, spirituality is a much more broad concept in terms of wellness and meaning of why do they exist? Who are they? How do they relate to other people, to the environment? Why were they created? Type of thing. Other people, it might be more of a formal, oh, I'm this denomination. I attend this church. Or this is what I was taught growing up. So finding out if they do have affiliations, if they attend a church, synagogue, or other practice, how closely they follow or don't follow the teachings of the groups that they're with. One question I think is really cool that they list in this list of questions for assessment incorporating spirituality is the idea of assessing how we experience God's guidance in your personal life. I think this can be so diverse. Some clients might say, hey, I pray. Others, I've had clients that say, you know what? I just feel at peace when I just sit out in nature or when I go for a walk. Other people say, you know, I read the Bible. I do a Bible study. I talk about this. I meet with a group of women or guys and we talk about God. Oh, I used meditation or spiritual based books. So finding out what that means for them. Another question you might want to ask them, are you aware of any spiritual resources or practices in your life that could help you cope with your problems? What have you tried in the past? Is there anything that's worked for you or anything that really hasn't? For people who might self-report that they consider themselves, quote, spiritual, they oftentimes might say, you know what? I mean, I've heard this so many times from clients. I remember when I used to attend such and such church. We used to go to church. We used to be involved in these meetings at our congregation. We used to take part in these certain things. I remember one couple, we were doing marriage counseling. And actually, they didn't mention up front that they wanted anything of a Christian or spirituality-based nature. They were coming in to deal with anger and forgiveness issues related to an affair that the husband had had. But as we were processing the factors that weighed into the affair and the plan for what they were going to do to try and avoid situations that could foster an affair again, interestingly enough, one of the things that came up is this couple mentioned that they had come from a small town in another part of Ohio, and in that small town, they were highly involved in their church community. But then they said when they moved down to the, quote, big city here in Columbus, they found it difficult to connect with people. One of the other questions that we need to look at, also including assessment of spirituality, is asking about if the client has an expectation that we be involved with consulting with their spiritual or religious leaders. Now, one of the things I found interesting as I was preparing for this seminar is realizing that there are actually standardized assessments out there that approach spirituality. I wasn't aware of this initially. So there's things that measure issues like orthodoxy, meaning how rigid someone does things by the letter of the law, versus how they might do things more by the spirit of the law. So there are some people that, for example, their religious belief might be, you have to go to confession this often a year in order to be absolved from your sin. Or you have to say this thing so many times a day. Or you have to go to church so many times a week or month or year. So it might be interesting to know how rigidly a client believes that they have to do these things, because again, that weighs into their meanings and their concepts of things like justice and mercy. There are also standardized measures out there about spiritual identity in terms of how a client links their sense of worth and relationship to God. It's interesting, for example, if a client believes that God's merciful, they might say, wow, even though I did A, B, and C, they might have an outlook about, but I get another chance, and how they approach that, versus someone who believes God is a strict judge who's ready to catch them doing things that are opposite what he desires, and that he is the one who orchestrates punishment. There are also standardized measures out there about level of religious commitments, and that people have different judgments as to why they do what they do in terms of their commitment to their religious views. Is it more out of the inward parts of their heart, where internally they just have a sense that they, maybe they're altruistic, maybe they're a giver, just being kind and moral and other focused is something that's important to them? Is it part of their internalized belief system? Or is this something that is more externally imposed? There's a phrase the literature talks about even in terms of standardized assessment, and it's called God image. Basically, this is the client's perception of who God is. And you can use this with things like we talked about earlier with the operational definitions in terms of, is God love? Is he a strict judge? Is he forgiving? Is he a loving father? And a lot of times they found in the literature the God image is really linked to a lot of issues with family of origin. So it's interesting that sometimes someone will apply onto God qualities, good or bad, that they feel that they experience with their family of origin. Or sometimes they'll do the exact opposite and say, oh my, I went through all this abuse and all these expectations that were toxic, and I am glad that now, spiritually, I'm finding another way of approaching things. There's also different tests and measurements out there that look at how congruent what someone says they believe spiritually is with what they're actually doing. There's assessments that incorporate someone's sense of spiritual well-being, their ideas about meaning and purpose in life. And there's assessments that look at religious problem solving. So again, this is not just about technique, but it's about character. It's about relationship with the client. It's about the narrative of the person's journey. So things we could ask a client are, how has religion or spirituality influenced your life? Tell me about God. What does spirituality mean to you? Help me understand how you learned about spirituality or religion. How do you think God views you? Tell me about spiritual or religious traditions in your family. How do you define spirituality or religion? What spiritual or religious messages were handed down through your family? And remember, sometimes these messages are said directly, but oftentimes they're not. They're implied. So those might be some things we want to filter through with a client in our sessions. This also, I think, is a very, very interesting question that can tell you where the client's at, this next one. Do you believe that spirituality / religion causes more harm than good, or more good than harm? And that can really get at the spiritual development and where the client's at currently. They might be reevaluating the spirituality that there was in their home growing up versus what they want. I can't tell you how many times people have said, oh, I grew up in this type of home, either where people didn't talk about God, and now I realize I want that in my life, or vice versa. They might say, you know, I grew up in a really strict home, and I felt like life was just a bunch of rules of things to be avoided. And now I'm coming to learn that God's just not ready to zap me for everything, that He actually is merciful. He actually wants a relationship with me. So it's interesting to see how the clients perceive that. Another type of question that can be useful with clients, what is your earliest memory about God? Were you raised in a religious family? What was that like? What are your current religious beliefs? What about when you were a child or teenager? And then who had the greatest spiritual or religious influences? What's influenced your faith the most? And how would you describe that today? What have been some of your best or worst spiritual experiences? So really, you know, hopefully you're hearing that there's a number of different types of questions we can use with clients to really explore their spiritual journey. There is a term in the literature that I wanted to bring to your attention, and that term is spiritual differentiation. Basically, in terms of what we call spiritual maturity, over time, after someone reaches kind of an impasse or a crossroads, maybe they had a significant life experience, maybe they had to reevaluate, do I believe what people have told me to believe? What do I think about situations? They decide about who am I? How do I make sense of this stuff around me? So identifying and describing themselves as separate and distinct from others. This thing called spiritual differentiation is really necessary for healthy emotional and spiritual development. They've actually found that people that are able to make those decisions on that journey about what do I believe for myself have had a greater capacity for intimacy in relationships. They allow others to be more themselves. They exhibit more emotional stability. And they're more open to discussing spirituality. Another exercise I've included in your PowerPoint that you may want to go through, and you may want to, you know, after I give this example, kind of pause the tape just to be able to try this for yourself. Look at what are your thoughts, views, or beliefs on certain key issues. Again, our goal as a clinician is never to impose our worldviews on our client, to lecture them, to disciple them, to make them come to a certain point of view. But it's important for us to self-evaluate so we can differentiate between what we think on an issue, what our client thinks, and how we're going to best get into the client's worldview in a way that it will be beneficial for them. So it might be interesting to look at issues like, what do you believe about abortion? About the death penalty? About drinking or drug use? About watching an R-rated movie? Pornography? Premarital sex? About discipline? Domestic violence? Issues like tattoos or piercings? And for some people, these may not be spiritual issues. For others, they may be highly tied to spirituality. So finding out what those mean for someone. You probably heard of the term motivational interviewing. Motivational interviewing is a way of exploring what the client wants to explore without imposing your own values. So it can look again at the spiritual competencies we talked earlier about. Culture, worldview, your self-awareness, human and spiritual development, communication, assessment, and diagnosis and treatment. So the pieces that are important when we're talking about motivational interviewing are collaboration, evocation, and autonomy. So collaboration is meaning that We develop the therapeutic alliance as a partnership or joining with our clients. We're moving together towards spiritual growth and change. Second, a second element of motivational interviewing is evocation, facilitating a desire and a readiness of clients to change from within rather than without. So basically looking at their level of individual differentiation and what they need to become who they feel like they're supposed to be. And then finally, autonomy, helping clients take ownership of their own experience of their client narrative. So when we're doing motivational interviewing, there's principles that we want to employ. Things like expressing empathy, so to avoid criticism and judgment. We want to develop discrepancy, meaning that if someone's saying, wow, my spirituality and faith is so important to me, but then you're hearing about behaviors that seem to be in conflict with that, to really try and understand or discuss through that. Another aspect or principle that's important with motivational interviewing is that of rolling with resistance. You know, some theories have looked in the past at resistance as a horrible thing to be avoided. But sometimes how we respond to resistance and look at, oh, this is just a way that this person has tended to approach things, that, you know, this is just a habitual way that they've done this, we don't need to hyper-analyze it, can really be beneficial. And then the final principle of motivational interviewing is supporting self-efficacy, increasing the client's beliefs in their ability to make changes. So, as someone goes through their spiritual journey, they go through from maybe incorporating beliefs of other people, just kind of blind faith, not testing things, to eventually trying to make their own decisions, and then finally deciding what they believe for themselves. So the literature describes this in terms of what it calls four different statuses of where a person can be at. So the first one's called diffusion. Maybe they have no interest in the spiritual, or if they do have a religious or spiritual worldview, it's rather self-serving. They might have had limited exposure to religious and spiritual worldviews. The second status is called foreclosure. Again, this is, I'm just doing what I've been told. Mom and Dad told me that you do nice things for others and they'll do something for you. Mom and Dad told me that you better fear God or else, so that's why I'm doing A, B, and C action. So again, it's basically more of an external thing. And then as you go through these different statuses, on the third and fourth, you hear more differentiation in terms of spiritual development. The third status is called moratorium. So this is where there's a place of sincere self-reflection and self-examination. What happens is oftentimes this happens when there's a great uncertainty. Maybe there's just something that brings home the idea of, I've got to make sense of this. It could be a traumatic event. It could be a loss. It could be something that catches you off guard or forces you to try and struggle with the meaning of something. So with this moratorium, a person's having to evaluate things for himself or herself. Sometimes the client's coming to us because maybe it's the first time they've really had to evaluate something for themselves. And then the final status that's listed is achievement. This is where a person's taken time to think and decide what their internalized religious and spiritual beliefs are. Maybe they've gone through a spiritual journey and had a conversion experience. They've decided what they want to be their individual ways of looking at things. So, Oakes and Raphael talk about spirituality and development. Again, just like we go through human development in terms of from one age to another or one life stage to another, there's a concept of spiritual development. Over time, there may be what they call illumination, awareness of different possibilities, and deciding how much or how little we want those possibilities to be incorporated. There's a sense of individuation, learning to esteem oneself, to find out who was I created to be. And this goes to a concept that the literature calls mattering. The literature highlights the fact that as clinicians, we have a significant influence on this concept of mattering. Just by the empathy that we give a client, just by hearing their narrative, just by being present, and by having high levels of Rogers process variables, we can aid the client in their journey towards individuation. Over time, one of the things that we might see happening is them starting to explore and seek answers to God-related questions. And then ultimately, they might come up with some sense of explanation or purpose in life. So, just to review, again, some of the things we talked about this first session of today's seminar. Spirituality can be broad for some people. For others, it may incorporate specific religious views. But the goal is that we want to develop competencies in terms of relating to a client in terms of multicultural competency in the area of religion and spirituality. How they communicate, listening to their narrative, any themes that seem to come up, their operational definitions, the way they approach things, what they believe is the cause or causes of the problem that they're coming in for, and what they think might be part of the solution. So there's a lot of different aspects that we can incorporate in terms of spirituality. Supervision can be a great tool to role model for a supervisee how spirituality might be a significant part of conceptualizing a case. We talked about operational definitions, and truly I think one of the most successful tools that I found when I meet with someone who says they want spirituality incorporated into their counseling has been to find out and really discover with the client what his or her operational definitions of certain concepts are, like mercy and justice, religion, spirituality. It's important for us to be aware of our own narrative spiritually and what's contributed to that, as well as what that means for our clients. Again, that could be everything from not wanting to incorporate talks about God or spirituality, feeling like they hate or don't like whatever they think that would be. That could be religious affiliations and formal ways of handling things. There's a lot of different aspects of it. That could be looking at how to approach different issues and make meaning and sense of that. So effective therapy, again, is therapy that is professionally and ethically sound. We can't just say, oh, just because this person wants spirituality-based or Christian-based therapy that we can do anything that isn't supported ethically. We need to make sure the approaches that we're using, even when we do tailor or hear or incorporate the narrative spiritually, are also things that are professionally sound. Then we talked finally about spiritual differentiation. The idea that over time, through the spiritual journey, a client, or even ourselves in our own life, will have a tendency to decide what we really believe and why we believe it. That initially, it might have been based on other people or what we were taught. But as we go through challenges and significant events in life, we might realize what we personally believe. And looking at the values and beliefs that we have and how we want those incorporated. For example, you know, there's a technique that I've been reading more and more in the literature about lately called acceptance and commitment therapy. And I've been finding lately that with a number of our clients that request more spirituality and religious worldviews incorporated into their counseling, that a lot of times they benefit from when we identify those core values and beliefs that are important to them. And when we look at how the actions of people around them, beliefs or other things, support or don't support those. I talked about motivational interviewing being a way of joining or partnering with a client cooperatively, helping the clients to take ownership of their goal of change and to be ready for incorporating that. I talked about principles like expressing empathy, rolling with resistance, and just being supportive of the clients, helping bring them through that spiritual narrative to hopefully what is going to be more illuminating, more helping them reach spiritual differentiation. So when we come back for the second part of today's seminar, we're going to look at the issue of God images and processing counseling concerns and the different aspect of God's images that might be something that we want to incorporate in our counseling with someone.